The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, excuse me, a couple weeks ago, Spirit Rock does a newsletter, and they asked some of us to write some reflections on sila, on ethics, and I wrote a couple paragraphs and thought to actually read that and then to unpack that and reflect a little bit. So here's what I wrote. Make of yourself a refuge for all beings. The Buddha enjoins us to cultivate this radical heart, a cultivation expressing not only sila, but also samadhi, unification of mind, and panya, wisdom. To be safe for others entails a path of self-discovery, humility, sensitivity, and willingness to be softened by one's own suffering. Goodness ripens through a process of letting go, and letting go involves a measure of grief. We grieve the harm done to us and the harm done by us. We grieve the human condition, the indivisibility of life and suffering. This process is autobiographical, idiosyncratic, and universal. To be mindful of goodness brings love. To be mindful of pain also brings love. This asymmetry is the miracle. The more attuned we are to our heart and its instant karmic reverberations, the clearer our ethical life will be. The more unified the mind becomes, the deeper the love will be. Boundless, nothing but warmth. The effortless care that is the face of emptiness. And we learn unwaveringly that hatred is never the last word. To see more is to love more. Sila expresses the entire path. And then we begin again. The story we tell about love is never final. New questions, complexities, and debts arise. Might I owe more than I suppose? The ego complicates everything. I want to think of myself as a really good person, and I don't really want to change my behavior. Ethical development stagnates when we rationalize our preferences. It's conceivable that goodness entails much more than even we good people are accustomed to giving. Just because the saint is extremely rare doesn't mean that anything less, strictly speaking, is justifiable. I can imagine in the not-distant future a major reconfiguration of our ethical obligations to non-human animals, to the egregious suffering of the most vulnerable around the globe, and to future generations. This is a time for radical hearts. I don't usually feel up to the task, but I am steadfast in keeping a relationship with my own sense of moral incoherence. From that relationship, I hope that I evolve and contribute more of what I owe to the welfare of others. The path unfolds. And then, at some point, it's time to die. The final gesture of letting go, which is both deeply poignant and also not such a big deal. Your life was made complete by what you gave away. So the animating force of the Dharma is non-harming. Yeah. That what's postulated is that we really cannot be happy. We can't be deeply happy if we're harming ourselves or others. And clinging, ignorance, is a kind of harm that we do to ourselves. And freedom, maybe, is when we stop harming ourselves. So this invitation, injunction from the Buddha to make of oneself a refuge for all beings, that's always been deeply moving to me. Even before I had any real sense of what I meant, just when I heard those words, it was just like, oh yeah, to make the heart safe for all beings. You know, that Dzogchen Tsedzhitu says, like, no being need fear me. That's a very beautiful offering, yeah? But what makes us unsafe for others? At some level, we can see that the harm we do is invariably the steam that arises out of the engine of the defilements, the kilesas, greed, hatred, delusion. We don't harm each other, harm ourselves from awareness. Yeah. And so to be safe for others entails this radical path of transforming anything that might be fertile ground, yeah, for harm. And that means, at minimum, that we must, this is a path of self-discovery, we must know ourselves really well, yeah. That it's in some ways it's in those junctures of the gaps of self-awareness from which harm can arise. And so we want to know the contours, the landscape of our minds, our hearts really well in order to afford more and more safety for others. And we want to become more and more sensitive. And by sensitive, that doesn't mean brittle. It means that we are more and more attuned to the subtleties of impact. Yeah, more and more attuned to the ways in which our, you know, heart, mind, speech, action has impacts. And there's a deep measure of humility in this. Yeah? Just to see those moments when we know we need to let go and not be able to do it. When we have the intention not to be harmful and are. Yeah. And when we project our experience, life, social location on that of another and misconstrue them. Yeah, is another way in which we fail to afford like the true sense of refuge for other beings. And we in cultivating this kind of safety for ourselves, for others, there's this deep willingness to be softened by our own suffering. That at some level, to me, is like the heart of the Dharma, is that we will not squander suffering. You know, we will use it to soften the heart. Yeah. And this kind of goodness, this safety, it ripens through a process of letting go, a willingness to feel that the process of letting go is a real deep tolerance for the imperfection of the moment. And that kind of process, that letting go, involves a measure of grief. Not merely grieving the inevitable losses of a human life, but actually the way the Dharma unfolds through the heart, the way we actually let go, it feels like grieving sometimes. Yeah, even if you don't even know what you lost. Yeah. So, to the extent that that is a core mechanism through which we develop insight and compassion, please know you're not doing it wrong. That's an element of the path. And we grieve the harm done to us, the harm done by us. Yeah. We look back on our own lives, just naturally it happens, even without the intention to do that. We look back on our own lives and we see the ways in which we've been unskillful, caused harm. And we have to integrate that into the heart as like appreciating, our capacity to do harm, the confusion, pain that created conditions for it, maybe. And this also involves understanding harm done to us, yeah? A way of more fully absorbing the body blow of that and feeling our way through it, making our own sense of it. Maybe forgiveness. And through this process, there's a kind of consolidation of the wish to be to be good, to not do harm. We grieve the human condition, that no matter how skilled we get at manipulating conditions, life and suffering are indivisible, that we cannot control the tides of pleasure and pain. We can influence much, but we cannot control, nor do we own anything. And at first, opening to that, to the First Noble Truth, feels like grieving. But at some point, the First Noble Truth actually nourishes the heart. To comprehend suffering, this is what we're asked to do. The Buddha says, comprehend suffering. And to comprehend suffering is different than suffering. Yeah. This process there are a lot of universalities in it, but also so much of it is very autobiographical, very idiosyncratic. So there are universalities of appreciating what is shared by all beings. That we are small creatures that are find ourselves in unimaginably like vast, potent forces of nature, and we long to be safe, to be at peace. This we share, yeah. And And there are many idiosyncratic features of our minds. Sometimes when I do practice discussions, I'll see, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 people just in a row, actually, meeting for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or something. And we're all practicing the same path, and yet the variations in the different minds, like coming through the door, is just staggering, really. And what that draws out in me, you know, based on that, is also very different. And so it's like I feel like almost a different person depending on what we're sitting with in the room. The variations are just enormous. And so we want to actually appreciate the ways in which this path is always improvisational. It has to be our own idiosyncratic path, how these teachings actually take fire in our hearts and minds depends on our own history. And insofar as much of what we're trying to establish is a sense of safety in our own experience, to make our inner life more and more safe, that is a deeply autobiographical process, because we have all had different experiences with respect to threat and safety, yeah. With respect to wounds and healing. To be mindful of goodness brings love. To be mindful of pain also brings love. Yeah, and that asymmetry is a miracle. Why is that so? How is it that bringing the same quality of steady, open-hearted awareness to goodness potentiates it, becomes bigger, and bringing that awareness to pain reduces it? Yeah? This is something for us to explore, not to trust. Yeah. The more attuned we are to our heart, the clearer our ethical life will be. Yeah. So the more we actually see in our own hearts and minds, the more we actually recognize the kind of instant karmic reverberations of our life. Like, sometimes we talk about karma in a kind of grand terms, but one of the features of spiritual development is that the instant karmic effects become more and more apparent. To do good feels good, to not feels bad. Yeah. We actually start to attune to that. And this feedback is instantaneous. As the mind stabilizes, there is a deepened capacity for love. The love gets bigger. Yeah. The more, this is one of the ways that sila and samadhi are connected. So as the mind stabilizes, becomes more unified, more pliable, malleable, it can take on the coloration of love more fully. It's just like one drop of love into a mind that is steady flavors everything. And we can gather so much that there's a sense of nothing but love. Nothing. There is. We are aware of nothing but love radiating. And this this kind of care is the face of emptiness, the way that emptiness manifests is a radical nonviolence. This is a Nagarjuna. Wherever there's a belief that things are real, desire and hatred spring unendingly. Unwholesome views are entrained from which all disputes come. Indeed, this is the source of every view. Without it, no defilement can occur. Thus, when this is completely understood, all views and all afflictions vanish utterly. When there's a belief that things are real. So, you know, we might hear this and the mind says, like, okay, I'll believe things are not real. Yeah. But this is not so much about adding views, but subtracting the ways in which we are manipulating experience. So this is not about picking up another view, but as we empty, there's a kind of perceptual mode that ourselves, the world, has at least a slightly dreamlike quality to it. And this affects our sense of our body, the sense of, you know, the Vedana feeling tone falls away, sense of measuring self and world falls away, the sense of anything mattering more than this moment of awareness falls away. And this is not exactly a state of love, but it is a state where harm is absurd. Yeah, to do harm, it's not something we must relinquish, renounce, try to avoid. To do harm is absurd. And we learn unwaveringly that hatred is never the last word. To see more is to love more. Our hatred always leaves something out. We're always selectively picking and excluding data. And hatred cannot endure a deeper look in. We have to learn this in our bones. Yeah. Like for that the kind of hatred, anger, like that sense of real division, it's like that's just never the last word. There's something more to be seen. And so we say sila expresses the entire path. And then we begin again. The story we tell about love is never final. Dharma, path of Dharma, is a kind of perpetual rewriting of our autobiography. A rewriting of what the Dharma is. We ought never get too comfortable with our stories. Some are definitely better than others. Yeah. But we keep actually evolving and deepening, adding more nuance, more details, more wisdom to how we actually construe our lives, our history, what we've done, what's been done, what we are to do. And so, for me, I all Dharma talks to some measure are kind of autobiographical. Of course, there are these teachings, these like beautiful teachings in this Buddhist tradition, and they're inevitably filtered through our own experience. And so, for me, you'll hear a certain grappling in these the reflections that follow as I try to make sense of my own ethical life, my own responsibilities. And so we commit, you know, as a society, and then at an individual level, we commit to ethical evolution. Yeah, like what the kinds of cruelties that were unquestioned 100 years ago are many of them are now universally rejected. Yeah. But what cruelties do we tolerate now that in 100 years will be rejected? Our ethical life is so profoundly influenced by the cultural standards and mores that we tend to assume that the way we're living, so long as it doesn't diverge dramatically from societal standards, is what's asked of us, yeah? And so the question of what does goodness entail, that is a profound question. Yeah. And usually the way Sila is framed, our ethical obligations are framed in terms of the negative, what acts we are not to commit, yeah? But the question of what do we owe to others, what acts of omission are problematic? Yeah? That's a question. And when I look in to these questions, my own egoic identifications complicate everything. Yeah? The sense of like not wanting to do good, but to be a good person, to think of myself as a good person, complicates things. Because I want to think of myself as a good person, and I usually don't want to change my behavior. Can I be good acting just the way I've been acting? Yeah. And that kind of friction within the realm of egoic identification is, it stagnates our ethical evolution. And so the reflections that I'm introducing here, are there not another way of like compounding guilt or something like this, yeah? That's just another kind of manifestation of ego. But this is looking at the ways in which our insistence on viewing ourselves as good actually compromises our ethical life. And so we see how easy it is to rationalize and justify our own lives. And it is conceivable to me that goodness entails much more than even we good people are used to giving. You know? Just to like actually take that question into the heart. And I think about a saint, I think about our moral heroes, I think about Martin Luther King, and you know, and I'm no saint, but is anything less actually ethically justifiable? Yeah, just because the saint is extremely rare does not mean that we owe less. Yeah. And so I do wonder what we owe to the most vulnerable around the globe, to non-human animals, to the future generations that will be profoundly impacted by the choices we make. What do we owe? And this question has been kind of sort of almost haunting me for about 20 years. Reading a book in college that looked at begins with this question, this principle: if it's in our power to prevent something bad from happening without sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, we ought morally to do it. That was Peter Singer. And then I read this book that just like as a college kid living, a life of a college kid. And the recognition, the moral recognition that what $100 does for me, the amount of pleasure, goodness, safety it buys me, is just utterly trivial compared to what it does for the people in most need. But I went on spending my $100 on myself for the most part. And that introduced a sense of moral incoherence into my life. Like, oh, I cannot justify my life fully. And that sense of moral incoherence that creates a friction in the egoic realm that is usually too much for us to tolerate. And so we paper over, we forget, as I forgot from 20 years ago, and now I'm coming back to it. Yeah. And the kind of commitment is like, I will stay in relationship with my own sense of moral incoherence. I will not abandon that to unconsciousness, to forgetfulness. That I actually want to feel the ways in which I am out of joint with my own values and the radical ways in which I privilege my own well-being over others. Now, I really want to acknowledge that sometimes we're, you know, there's a certain kind of caution I have in even introducing some of these themes, because there are times when we are tapped out energetically. Yeah. It's like, I can't give more. We're trying just to find a way through the hardship of a human life, to stay sober, to stay well, to support children, to do the things of life. And it's like to be asked to do more is it's too much, yeah? So we know song from Dylan. I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail, hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And so there are times when it's like we just have to take good care of ourselves. We need shelter from the storm. Dharma offers that, you know, to some extent. And suffering has a kind of, we pool our resources, our emotional, cognitive, attentional resources when we're suffering. It goes to healing the wound, yeah? And that is healthy and important. And then sometimes we have more energy. Yeah. We have something more to give. We have our well-being is stable enough. And then we ask the question, like, what will I serve? What are the implications of my own deepest values? What do they entail for my life, for my responsibilities to others? So the path unfolds, and then comes time to die. And I've spent a lot of time practicing with that and been around death quite a bit. And I don't want, even though I feel it feels quite familiar in some ways, I don't want to be seduced into thinking that I understand it. And so there's a certain way in which we have to leave a lot of room for not knowing what will this actually be like. To reflect upon it, to witness it, is different than to do it. And so I don't know, be humble about that, what that actually entails, what that will do to my heart. But from what I can see, is that at least in the context of a Dharma life, it is both like extremely poignant. It matters so much. And it's not such a big deal. That so often when we think about, like, I need more life, I want to keep going, that is a sense that life is not complete. But if there is a sense that life was complete, to ask for more is just greed. And what makes life complete? I would say knowing oneself. Ajahn Brahm said they're like chambers within chambers in the mind. We start to know more and more of that. Knowing ourselves and love. Yeah? That is our legacy. And so what we've given has made us complete. Think that would be a good life. So I offer these reflections for whatever they're worth. And as always, the invitation is to pick up what's of use and to leave the rest behind. This is a talk where these reflections feel raw in a kind of different way. And, you know, there's a saying like, you teach from the scar, not the wound. This is a little bit of a wound for me. Yeah? But I feel like it's important that that in our Dharma path, we there's elements of comfort and discomfort. And we don't want to get too accustomed to a comfortable Dharma path. So we ask ourselves questions. Let's just sit for a moment. So may our efforts together, may the efforts of this path, may they fill our hearts. As our heart is filled, overflows, may that goodness flow into the lives of others.